This is somewhat of a different problem than what we have seen in the vasculature, but the problem of fluid transport in the interstitial spaces, which are the spaces in between the capillaries and the parenchyma, it's one of those long-standing and classical problems in animal physiology, but it has resisted modeling and many through the years of many attempts, but still we do not have an adequate model of this type of transport. So I will just give you the ingredients to the problem rather than any ideas about how to model in that I may have now that in any case are still very raw. But also I'm going to show you some new experimental evidence that really motivated and fully justified, I think, to take another serious look to modeling the interstitial transport. And just to give you an idea of the status of things, and this you all, of course, know this, but the energy for fluid and solid transport is the work of the heart, and the concentration gradients of water and solute in the extravascular spaces, that's we want to propose that there are other elements also that contribute, at least for the interstitial transport. And traditionally, the net force is summarized by what is called the Starling principle, and this is just like the resultant of hydrostatic and colloidosmotic pressure determines whether there is filtration of or absorption from the capillaries into the interstitial tissues. And to give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem, if you consider a man maybe that or a person that is 70 kilograms, about 50 of those will be water, and most of them are intracellular, and the intracellular water is very well regulated, and we're not going to be concerned with that today. But circulating in intravascularly, there is about 5 liters. And then there is, you know, about 15 liters left, and all those are in the interstitial space. So there's a very important quantity of water that we have to think about, because it can impact this compartment very significantly. And so these red dots signifies the capillary wall, which is totally permeable to water, but is semi-permeable to other things that are in the blood. For example, the large proteins to cannot cross this membrane, so those proteins that generate what is called colloidosmotic pressure. And the water and the salt and small molecule cross freely, so they are equilibrated, but the large molecule are not. And so we have this will be hydrostatic pressure, the nomenclature, and the little Z is for capillary, and this is colloidosmotic pressure, the little Z for capillary, and the corresponding for the interstitial. And we have a very good experimental access to this side of the equation. This is where the problem is, you know, the models that we have account very well for this, but very poorly for this. And this is what we think we need to do a lot more work experimentally as well as modeling. So our experimental model is a tissue explant from the skin. You saw before that most of the water in the interstitial is in the skin interstitial. So we initially focused there, but this findings will apply almost to all the interstitial spaces everywhere in the organism. This is just, don't look at this, is very low max, so don't pay too much attention to this. I'm gonna show you larger magnification of the skin. This just show all this layer, you know, it was too big, so here's the epidermis, and then going down to the fat and the muscle, but those are the dimensions of that. And so, you know, we suppose there is a balance in which the hydrostatic pressure is nicely compensated by the ecologiosmotic pressure. And we want to know how changes in that balance, how that thing is balanced or regulated. And so any changes in the interstitial fluid volume is related to that resultant of pressure. And we can think of that in a time interval, or maybe, in a space interval, in a way. And then this term is for the lymphatic. I didn't mention before, maybe the lymphatic is like the drainage system. And this, I'll show you also some photograph of that. So we want to know the mechanism that regulate that, or the physiologic ranges, and within all the constraint that the forces, the geometry, and the physical-chemical properties of these interstitial spaces impose. And also, I don't think we can separate these things and say, I'll look at the forces, you look at the geometry, and somebody else will look at the chemistry. But these things form like a functional unit, and we really need to consider them all together in the same time. Okay. And so this is something I got from the internet, but it's an easy way to show the distribution in a schematic way. And the epidermis is here, okay, and it's about 80 to 100 micron. And this is where the capillaries are, and it's a very dense capillary wall. I mean, this is a mesh of capillaries. From time to time there are these loops. But this, which is of course a sagittal cut in here, is a very dense mesh, from like a covering all over our body, very dense. And this is the appendix. Don't pay attention, because they don't play in the type of transfer that we are interested. Which is the capillaries are here, close to the parenchyma, that is in the epidermis. But then there are these large spaces in which there are more than three or four hundred micrometers square, in which there are no capillaries or anything. So how does the transfer go through there? And I forgot to say that those 15 liters in the interstitial are renovated every day, so the fluid is continually moving. This is not a stagnated fluid. So a very small imbalance results in severe pathologies. And also, we don't know how that fluid contributes to maintain the volume of the circulating blood, which is very important to maintain all the pressure that are key for functioning. So, but I'll just point to the sweat gland. Sometimes when we talk about transfer of fluid in the skin, people think that it's part of the sweating, but that the water that we eliminate by sweat goes directly from the blood through outside. That's not part of the equation here either. So then there are other plexuses, but these are much more lax, and they don't compare in surface of exchange with this, which is massive, And so this is close up of this interstitial. Here's the parenchyma, okay? You can see the nuclei. And this is a preparation that, of course, distorts the reality of how these tissues are, because we want to, this hematoxylin and eosin, and many of you are probably familiar with that type of stain, the nucleus are a little bit, should be purple. And you have past this parenchyma, and it's that also had to be fed by diffusion of these cells, which are very fast growing, and they have very high metabolic demands. And then there are this fiber structure, which are collagen mainly, and then some elastin, and then some other components. But structurally, it's the collagen and elastin that are important. And here, okay, this will be that capillary mesh, okay, because this is like a cut perpendicular to the skin, so as you go down. And so here we are something like 100 micrometers into the skin. And so this is where the fluid will go, either this direction or the other. But like I said, this preparation leads out and distorts the spaces, because during the process, another material that is very important in the structure of the interstitial spaces is removed, and these are glycosaminoglycans. This is a gel-like material that is very hygroscopic, and there it's very complex physicochemical, but the main component for the purpose of water transport is hyaluronic acid. And hyaluronic acid, I'll show you more. Before I didn't go through the thermodynamic description, but you all saw there, if we have time, we'll go back, because when you want to describe a complex biological, maybe it's worth it to go back. So yeah, it's here, just because some of the terminology will appear. When we want to describe such a complex biological system, we use the term chemical potential. And chemical potential is just the free energy per mole of each one of the many components that are here, the J's, you know. And for water, we will have a concentration, we'll have a concentration part, then the pressure volume part, and for things other than water will be charge, and the gravity for our experiment will neglect it because it's going to be very small pieces of skin. So, but the concentration part is expressed with this little A, that's the activity, and the water activity that you perhaps will hear me talking is, of course, directly related to the chemical potential. And that is a very small number, and the activity of pure water is one. So the difference in activities is a very small number, so that log is negative, so it's the opposite direction of the pressure volume component. So this, so later on you are not surprised. So this is that capillary mesh that encircle all the body, and you see it's very dense. These little dots are those loops that, you know, they just will go closer to the epidermis, this is just to give you an idea of the structure that we will have to deal with. So this is, because it's so dense, you can consider just like a surface that is continuously leaking water and a small molecule, but it controls more of the other. And this is the lymphatic mesh, which is parallel to the capillary ones, but the vessels are much thicker, but it's very extensive, very dense. Just look at the date of this, and this was studied, you know, in the 30s, you know, up to the 80s, in which people went into molecular biology and they lost interest in the, but still the lymphatic system is again resurfacing in fluid control as a very important component of this balance. And here is something more recent, and here you can see the structure of this capillary tree is totally different, because they are blind beginning here in the skin, in the interstitial, so, and they can transport through the lymphatic system bacteria and very large tissue debris and cells coming in and out of here, so this is the drainage system. It's not surprising that it looks like that, I guess, a lot wider and low pressure, of course, and it has valves all the way up.
So what's driving the flow through there then?
Yeah, well, that's what we, okay. Yeah, that's one of, that's the key question.
Okay.
What's driving the flow of anything in the interstitial?
Yeah. Okay.
Because when, yeah.
But when you say interstitial, are you including that system in it? In other words, the lymphatics?
For the experimental part, I am not, but this is just eventually whatever we do separated of the lymphatic will have to include the we'll have to include the lymphatic, because 3 liters of those 15 liters
right.
that are renovated every day go through the lymphatic. So 3 liters is a lot, is, you know.
Right.
So
but in the 15, the lymphatics were included, is that?
Yes, the exactly, yeah. That's
not saying the volume of the lymphatics is that big.
It's not, it's sort of like a virtual volume,
yeah.
But it flows slowly but steadily. And you one of the problems with this is the estimate of lymphatic flow and flow in the interstitial and the pressure forced, you know, relationship in the interstitial are very hard to acquire experimentally, and they've been for a long time. So that's part of the problem. So, and now we get deeper into the skin, just to show you that part that has no capillary, and this is the type of structure that you see.
That's leather.
What?
That's leather. Leather.
Well, leather. It looks like leather, and I will show you real leather. See how similar this. This preparation is to do this hematoxylin and eosin slides. You had to fix, dehydrate, stain, rehydrate, and rinse. So what happened is the in-between fluid, which is the gel, it gets separated and move and remove, and so we get very distorted idea of these spaces. But you see the disposition, this is very good skin from a young pig, so maybe when we get older it doesn't look so pretty, but you see this very apparently organized distribution of the fiber bundles, okay, these are mostly collagen in here, this red, and some of them are cut, you know, perpendicular to the other in this particular slice, so this is a bundle that had been, you know, cut this way. And then you can see it's sparse number of cells here and there. And those are fibroblasts of the fibroblast lineage. And so there would be some of the myofibroblasts that they have contractile and the ability to pull on these fibers. And these cells also generate these fibers and maintain them and generate what is in here, but you cannot see it in this slide, but I will show you it to you next. This is real leather, you see, it's even more dry and with less fat spaces. But this is the other part that you don't see in the leather or in the other slice when you fix the tissues and dehydrate it. And this is a fresh frozen slice, a little bit thicker than the other of skin. And this here is the epidermis, you can see this scaly thing, that's the stratocornea, that's the dandruff. And then you see all this blue stain here, this is a hair that it was cut, you can see that. And what you see now is this blue stuff, you know, now you lose a lot of resolution, you don't see the fiber, but now you can see that this is a lot more, there are a lot more porous, it's a much more porous material than what the other look, and in here they have a lot more round, round shapes and so on. And also you can see that there is some an even distribution of the stain, there is a lot more of that glycosaminoglycan, charged glycosaminoglycan in here. So the intensity of the stain indicates either that there is more of them or that there are more of the one with charge. So that's, but at least this gives you another perspective, not to just start modeling with one of those dry slides that look like leather, because the reality of this tissue is different than that. And this is closer, and here you can see it even better. See, that's the epidermis, and that's the darker blue, and then you can see here very well how the fibers are completely covered. It looks like a, almost like a three-dimensional knit that is sort of loose, and in between you have these spaces. And so the other thing, that's another view. Again, and the other point is that this porosity, it looks like it's uneven. There is more in some places than in other, and that's of course very suggestive of a dynamic system in some places. Something's happened here that is not happening here, and so on, and more. So we want to get a hold of the at least of the forces and begin to understand this by having real reliable experimental data. So one of the systems that we use is this in vitro explants of live pieces of this of this skin. And this is just a very summarized way to present this type of experiments. And so this consists in cutting these pieces from a healthy pig, and Nicole had done a few of those. And so then, the live pieces are trimmed so that only the skin and the interstitial of the skin, which is very thick, you remember it's about 2 millimeters thick, is incubated in vitro in a physiologic solution that maintain all the cells alive, but we can control the colloid osmotic pressure. So now we can measure the change in the water in these explants as a function of this colloid osmotic pressure that we control. And now these are separated from any pressures that are from the vasculature or from the lymphatic system, and you only have the internal tension that is generated by the glycosaminoglycan and the fibers, and the pressure outside that we control. And so this is well known that almost any tissue, because of the glycosaminoglycan, will swell, okay? So the immediate conclusion is obviously when they were in vivo, they would know that swollen, so something is compensating for this pressure, okay? But this doesn't tell us what the pressure is here, but we also repeat experiment in parallel most of the time at different temperature to differentiate those component that are energy dependent from those that are not, okay? And here you already see clearly that there is a differences between, that there is an energy dependent component that keep this tissue from getting swollen as much. Also, I want for you to notice the error of this experiment, which is always less than 10%, this is all done with pieces from the same animal. And it's important to keep track where are the sources of error in this experiment. So we can measure these changes very, very accurately, I think, for being this type of animal experiments. And then you can also plot this data in different ways just to see what's going on. And in here, you can see that initially the volume increases very fast, and then not so fast, and then equilibrate, or at least it changes very slowly. And in biology, there are many processes from many different mechanisms for these processes, but then there are only a few equations that somehow you can always fit to these processes. And this is one of the usual suspects, and it gives you a way to condense and deal with a lot of data point in a very compact way. It doesn't tell you as much about the mechanism, but in here Dennis helped me with identify the meaning of this parameter, especially this one. You know, I have an idea, but for this one, which is related to proportional to the rate, it has to do the first derivatives. Dennis and Antonio also did that derivative just to confirm that they were not making mistakes. So anyway, but so this parameter, this is just like close to zero. Then you have one that is the maximum volume, so it gives you that directly. Then you have the time that it takes to reach that volume is 9.5. And then this rate parameters, which is the rate at this point with a proportionality factor, of course, that is this volume divided by this time, and then a constant is 4. Yes, that's what they get me from the first derivative to get the velocity at that point. And that helps a lot to deal with hundreds of data points rather than having to. So it in that sense, and also it has that familiar biological feel that, for example, you know, enzyme kinetics with Michaelis constant and all these phenomenological representation that we do in biology. So this feels familiar to biology. So now compare these parameters in different animals. Now the error increases, but you can also tell that we can still significantly see that there is something at 37 degrees doesn't swell as much. But then we want to know the relationship between the pressure and the volume, and that's what we are after. And for this, we do somewhat more complicated experiments. In here, a piece is taken and then divided in many different pieces that are identical, except that some are incubated and 4 are 37, and then many replicates within a range of pressures. And so depending on the pressure in which they are equilibrated, some of them will swell, some of them shrink, and the one that don't change that tell us which one is the what we call, which equilibrium is a way to put it, but it's not, it just gives an idea what was the pressure in which the tissue were in vivo when it was taken from the animal. And when you do that with 7 different animals, you surprisingly see a huge variability. Now these animals are perfectly healthy. This is the perfect skin. They're young female piglet, you know, they have very nice pink skin. So this variability is physiological. You see how these errors, much larger than the measuring error that we had when we were trying to do in the same animal, that it was always less than 10% and sometimes, most of the time, less than 5%. And then there is this difference is between the 4 degrees and the 37 degrees, so it's sort of constant and significant. That one it doesn't vary nearly as much. So the difference between the component that is energy dependent or not is very similar for even within that variability. But what that tells us that in vivo, the radius of pressure could be from 3 to 107 and the millimeter of mercury. This is huge. This is huge. All the when you directly look at the pressure here, it's all around 0, 2 or 3 millimeter of mercury and all that. But here it is. You know, this is what we get. You know, and the pressure in this solution we measure with a membrane osmometer, which is the most accurate way that you have that we have to measure colloid osmotic pressure, and it's what is used in clinic to determine the colloid osmotic pressure in blood samples.
Excuse me, I may have missed it.
Yeah.
How do you estimate swelling by weight?
This is this is just precision weight, and since what we are changing here is the water, this is a very experimentally simple experiment. Doesn't have any complication, and the colloid osmotic pressure we control with inert polymers. So that even if they have some penetration a little bit, they're totally inert. It's polyethylene glycol of extran or so on. So, so still we, that equilibrium pressure obviously is so variable that we cannot use it very well to look for relationship between the pressure and the volume. But so for that we do a different type of experiment. You just get the tissues to swelling, so to equilibrate, and here at least we know that those tissues, especially this remember before, it will very nearly equilibrate, but and then we drop or change the pressure, and then we see how the volume changes. And now we know exactly from where to where the pressure is changing. And then it goes to another equilibrium point, okay? And it happened that this also fit that type of equation, and in fact, remarkably well. This is the not correlation coefficient, but the regression coefficient for that those empirical fitting. And again, so we can get those differences. And if these are the data for that 105 millimeter mercury drop, but if we do that for many other pressure, then surprise, surprise, we get a linear relationship, and this stationary values for the relationship between the velocity and the pressure. And you know, and anybody that is interested in modeling can understand how that is a very good thing to have. The fact that now you can within all that variation, you still have this constant slope here as the relationship. And so all these other experiments were telling us that there's something dependent on the temperature, and so that points to metabolic control in the cell, also to maybe material modification of collagen with temperature, but that's more controversial. But then you can, we did different experiments to test the hypothesis perhaps that the cell's energy contribution was contributing to that difference, because I told you that this Myofibroblasts are contractile, so they can contribute to the tension in these tissues. Again, remember, this is totally separated on neurological and vascular and lymphatic control, because I know people are saying, well, you know, but if it were, if this were attached to an animal, there are many non-controls that could do that. But in here, the cells are, yes, responding on their own. And iodoacetamide is a well-known inhibitor of anaerobic metabolism, of the glycolysis generation of ATP, not very efficient, but it's very vital because it functions when the tension of oxygen is low. And of course, this type of biological experiment you have to take with a grain of salt. There are many possibilities, and so this is just an example. It goes with a whole lot of array of other controls and other inhibitors to demonstrate, but because we have that linear relationship, we can easily calculate that the contribution that is sensitive to the iodoacetamide is as much as 23 millimeter of mercury, already a lot more than anything that was measured before as the average there. So this suggests very much that the cells had to be taken into account, and that there is a local control mechanism that can generate and counter pressure that are very, very high, okay? And this is important when one consider, you know, people were talking about whether the aorta move when it beats, you know, all this tension that the cell can generate to maintain this elastic constraint on the tissues that this cell can generate. And this is only the anaerobic metabolism, but of course, you can also do measurement, put in inhibitors of the oxygen-dependent oxidative metabolism. You know, and we are doing those studies now to see the various contributions, and it gets very complicated. Like anything that has that range of control, you would expect to find that complication. Okay, but at least this system very clearly showed these large differences. Okay, so let's summarize up to now, and because I wasn't sure how long we still have some time. So that the magnitude of the pressure is much larger than previously considered, and so that's the big important point. It could be, as you know, at least 60 for sure, 60 millimeter of mercury, and probably over 100. And by the way, the part of the problems with the previous models is that they would not account, for example, for experimentally measure drop in pressure that happen, for example, when there is edema, when there is a burnt, or when there is severe damage to the interstitial tissues or to any tissues, then if you block the circulation in animal, of course, then you can measure pressure drops of about 100 millimeter of mercury. And that was a mystery. Why? How could that possibly happen? You know, but so the potential to this swing in pressures is there, at least in the skin interstitial. And of course, we are exploring this in all the other interstitial in the organism. Okay.
So what direction is that? What's the direction?
Either one. So if we decrease the cholecystosmotic pressure of the bathing, you know, it will be the equivalent of decreasing the pressure in the circulation, then the tissues swell, taking in liquid. If we concentrate at the outside, you know, it will be like a negative pressure, then the tissues accommodate and flow out the water down. So maybe you are thinking of something that is very clear. That is what is called the initial stages of cardiac decompensation with the compensated heart failure or heart insufficiency.
Right.
And this is mechanism now, it's always speculative how is it that you can compensate, and this bulimia increases, and this is now is an easy way in which this could happen, because you have this regulatory mechanism can really counteract a large pressure.
But gradient implies a direction. Are we talking about a direction, or
Yeah, a direction that dependent of the physiologic necessity can go in either direction sometimes, and that was not, you know, the gradient goes from the tissue to the blood.
So it's a pressure difference.
Yeah, it's pressure different. Well, gradient, well, we call it, because what we measure is pressure different macroscopically, but they are gradients, and I want to give you, if we have time, some evidence that there are gradients that are actually maintained, you know, and for that was that other concept of the activity of water, the water activity, which is what generates, it's the same thing as this colloidosmotic pressure. So this also important, and then, oh, so you were talking because I put this linearly related to the pressure gradient. Yeah, what's
the gradient at the top? I just wondered whether that was really a pressure difference rather than a gradient.
Yeah, well, it's a pressure difference, but I assume that involved a gradient, that it's not like a step, you know, that you don't go. Yeah.
Okay, I know.
Yeah,
okay, yes.
Yeah, let's see, that is, it's more like it's a gradient, not just a sudden, you know, collapse or something. And then, of course, we're left with this problem, you know, revisit that thing of before, how complex was that interstitial geometrically, but it's necessarily related to the whole process, okay? And this, I will pass that, but so now they're looking at those gradients, there are now new modalities by which you can now, with a really high resolution look at, by magnetic resonance imaging of the energy status of water, and there was very many talks in here this week, so I won't even try it, but the way I see it, the T2 parameter, this is an image of, the image is not the actual measurement, but it just to illustrate how there are this very big difference. This is like the water, this is the tissue is equilibrated with a solution, then it's much darker, and then here the fact, and here is the muscle. So there's differences in the in that T parameters. And so you can, this technique that people have talked in here about measuring, I think somebody talked about this, somebody did at least briefly about this technique, but anyway, you can determine this T2 parameter that is related to the energy status of water, because it's the majority of the nuclei here are from water, and so those nuclei are interacting with other components of the tissue, and let's say the glycosaminoglycan, the time or the relaxation time changes, you know. I cannot even begin to do this or to explain the theory behind this. But this T2 parameter is related to the water activity. So the higher it is, the more free that water to move is, meaning the higher the activity is. The point of that is, if you measure that T2 parameter across the dermal layer, starting from the outside, you see that it varies. Now there are some increases and then decreases, and I take this to demonstrate that there are water activity gradients in the dermis, and the error of each one of these measurements that is making. It's about 10%. So that, you know, I don't know exactly, but clearly there are big changes within small distances. Okay, and you can also measure those directly, and I'm gonna go quickly, but I wanted to show some other experiment that this also related to the geometry. Remember when we looked at those tissue slides that they had the cells, they could be, they look either round or elongated, or so the cells could be located in different places within the tissue and be in relation to different size surfaces or elements in the tissue. And so many, and this is going down another scale now, going to the macromolecular pathways that mediate a lot of the processes that go on in the interstitium, including those that are related to the signal mediated responses of the cell. So for that, this also has to be considered. And so this experiment with the measuring the generation of coagulation factor 10A that is recognized as one of the generation of that factor, which is central in the coagulation pathway under more biologically relevant condition, is a rate limiting factor. So looking at generation of factor 10A is relevant for the whole, or at least a good indication for the whole coagulation pathway. And so this experiment, everything is identical except that some cells that have the molecule that initiate this pathway express on the surface are either kept in suspension, and that will be like the size of one cell, and or they are located or attached into a much larger microcarrier particle, okay? And again, these reactions are totally surface dependent because it really requires lipids, and the initiated molecule, which is tissue factor, is a transmembrane protein. So these are surface dependent reactions. And so in this experiment, everything exactly the same except the size of the surface that is being doing, except the surface where the reaction is taking place. And you can see very clearly that the same amount of everything identical, but there is a big difference in the amount of product that is generated when the surface is much larger, okay? The other thing that I wanted to show is that within the pressure gradients, they also that influence in the activity of the macromolecular pathway. So these are all factors that would have to be considered, and how things change at that mesoscopic scale in the tissues. So, but you see that all the ingredients we had relatively good access experimentally to them. So we could, in reality, make these measurements with the refinement in the MRI techniques and all that. So. And the other thing in here that's normalized is that it looks that even the profile of the places where the reaction change also depend on the size, but I'm not so sure of that. This result, by the way, is expected from the diffusion theory, because there's what is called, for reactions that are limited by diffusion, there is that smaller cascade limit in which the determining factor is the diameter of the colliding particles. And because the substrate of this reaction is very small relatively to these two diameters, then this diameter is the one that determines the rate of collision, and therefore the rate of the reaction. Okay? So I will just gonna pass all this thing because we are all tired. Very tired. I'm tired too. But I want to, just go over again through this thing of the collaboration and the relationship between modeling and experimental and doctor and so on. And so it clearly we need to organize, and we want to understand and to predict all the information that we have, and so we can. There are two general approaches that they usually are combined, and one is a large integrity model in which we just almost like to keep track of everything when we just can no longer, have more things stored in our head. And so, but surprisingly, if you do this right, then sometimes there's some property almost emerge from this complexity without being looking for. And then, this the most rewarding that we all like the most, in which you can take a very simple and try to find where the simplest component that can reproduce the biological observation. And for that, it is clear that we just need to have, because we cannot be good at everything, obviously, so we have to have good people that are the best in everything, but all working together on the same thing, not each one of them separated, but just pick on the same program, the problem, and then understand it to the same level, that problem. But then the expertise is, you know, that's what would be the quality of the what the person, there is an expert, even if I may know everything about that modeling, it would not be the same as somebody that is a mathematician. So I'll stop there and I'll answer questions.